Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Tonight's guest is Tom Artle, who has banked table games in California for more than 20 years. We'll be speaking to Tom shortly. In the news, Caesars Entertainment seems to be playing some kind of a shell game. Four of its underperforming properties, including three on the Las Vegas Strip, have been sold to a company which is owned 58% by Caesars for $2.2 billion. Somehow this is supposed to help Caesars' financial position. Richard, what do you make of this?
You know, I've seen several people commenting this is shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. I don't understand how one company can sell something to itself and suddenly it has more money than it did in the past. I mean, somebody's getting screwed, right?
Well, it only owns 58% of the company it sold it to, so it's not quite selling it to itself.
I see. So the good news, though, is for players, it just adds more complications for somebody who gets trespassed. If you were trespassed in one of those properties, seems to me you have a good case for being able to go back in.
Well, but if you were going to sue them, then there's one more level of losses. Like already when Bob Nersessian is on, he says like he has to sue seven different companies when he's in Caesar's Palace because of all the different ownerships. So now if you get... He wants to sue somebody for something he did in the quad. Now it's eight.
So, right, right.
Oh, what fun. All right. On last week's show, we spoke of some gamblers in Maryland being arrested for using fake chips. The funny part of the story was they tried to get rid of the chips by throwing them into a lake near their home, and the chips floated. Now, there was a follow-up article on this, which created some big waves, and Richard got involved somehow. What happened?
Well, a guy for the Washington Post wrote a story. I think the focus of the story was really on surveillance and security at Maryland Live. And, he made the mistake of calling card counters cheaters in the article, as often journalists do. In one sentence, it was like, these people are in charge of catching card counters and other cheaters, something like that. And as you can imagine, the card-counting community's head exploded.
Yes.
And so apparently...
He got some letters?
Many, many, many very angry emails and some phone calls even. And so he decided he should write an article about this. And he contacted Professor Schwartz, who we've had on the show a couple of times. And Professor Schwartz recommended that he get in touch with me. So he called me and I sort of showed him the error of his ways. And one of the, now his new article hasn't come out yet that I'm aware of, but one of the interesting outcomes of all this is a guy named Norm, who has one of the two top blackjack sites called Blackjack the Forum, and he makes the Casino Verite blackjack software, which is the best blackjack software out there for card counters.
Been out there for 20 years or so.
Yeah, like 20 years. Anyway, he did a Google search for is card counting cheating and found that gets searched, I guess, 800 times a week, a month. I forget what it was. So he bought the domain is card counting cheating and has set up a site so that in the future, hopefully these journalists who type this into Google will get a little bit of an education before they write these articles.
Uh-huh. And you suspect Norm would say counting is not cheating. just a suspicion.
Oh, yeah. Well, he cites the various Supreme Court cases and, you know.
Good. So. All right. Now, Richard, you currently live in Southern California, and you're planning on moving to Las Vegas as soon as your youngest son graduates high school. So you started to get some ID in support of this move. What did you find out?
Boy, I went to DMV this morning and found out that just to get a Nevada ID, you have to bring your birth certificate and Social Security card. And if you want a driver's license, you need to bring that too, which seems much harder than – now, I haven't done this in a long time, but, boy, I could swear it was a lot easier to do this in California. And actually, I'd like to, if any of our listeners can help me out, I was there at about 8:15 in the morning. They opened at 8 o'clock, and there were already about 200 people at the Henderson office. So I'm wondering which is better to go to. Should I go to the Sahara DMV or the Henderson, if people know?
Well, there's a lot more than two. But actually,
here in Nevada, in the Las Vegas area?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's one on Flamingo at Cimarron, among other places. And
Well, I want to know the best one with the shortest
lines. All right. I actually have a lady who goes square dancing with Bonnie and me, works for the DMV. Maybe she would know that. I will... our listeners call in, but I'll get back to you, too.
Okay. And I should say, in California, you can make an appointment to do these things. You know, you can make an appointment online, and you show up, and you get through these things right away. So Nevada's really behind the times here.
Yeah, when I got my driver's license 21 years ago, I did not need to bring a birth certificate or a Social Security card.
Well, I mean, back prior to 9/11, I went into DMV in California and said, I'd like Richard Munchkin on my driver's license. You know, that's the name I use as a writer and in the movie business. And they were like, okay, fine, just gave it to me. That was it. I mean, I didn't need anything.
Is it hard to find a Richard Munchkin birth certificate?
Yes, it is. That would be very hard to find.
All right, same with Bob Dancer. All right, now, let's talk to our guest. Tom Artle was given a copy of Thorpe's Beat the Dealer for his 16th birthday. His father was an economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and Tom's upbringing included a lot of analyzing various wagering games and situations. He started counting cards in South Lake Tahoe at the age of 18. He met two very important men in his life in 1983. We'll talk about this. He started banking games in California in 1993. And he is a cancer survivor. Tom Artle, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you very much.
Briefly, what is banking games in California all about?
Well, originally in California, when the card rooms, which had been poker rooms, figured out a way to bank, I think it started with Pai-Gow tiles, and eventually Pai-Gow poker and blackjack, by using the same method as poker, where a collection is taken, or a time, as some people call it. This way, the casino was not involved in the action of the game. Basically, the casino was renting the table out, and the players would take turns being the bank and play against each other. And what we saw when we first got started in 1993, it was actually at an Indian casino. But when we got involved in the card rooms about 4 years later, we noticed that players would come in and you might have, say, a blackjack game. You might have five players. Three of them have $100 or less, and four of them would have $100 or less, and the fifth player might have $2,000. When he puts a $1,000 bet out and the bank only has $100, they can't cover the action. And so we saw a need for an outside group to come in and always be available to cover any bet. And that's sort of how we got into the banking business.
So this is there are three classes of gaming. This is class two gaming. So class three gaming allows the casino to be a casino. Class two, as you said, the casino is not allowed to do any gambling. They just can take a fee for every hand played. So,
and those classifications relate to Indian casinos. The and class one is tribal games. So If it's not an Indian casino, they don't use Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 designations.
Really? In the California card rooms, though, that isn't considered Class 2?
Yeah, they do call it Class 2. Yeah.
They do, and they're not Indian?
Yeah, they're not Indian.
No, they're not Indian. Yeah.
Have to go back and reread the Johnson Act because I think that's where it came from. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
So let me ask you. I mean, because a lot of blackjack players or a lot of whatever kind of advantage players, they go into these places in California and they see what's going on and they go, wow, the bank has a big edge, right? And many of them sit down and say, oh, I'm going to take some bankroll and sit on this game and bank it. But you did a much bigger, I mean, that was quite a leap to go from let's bank a table or two to let's bank every table at 14 casinos.
Yeah, well, when we first started in 1993, it was at an Indian casino. And, we were sort of experimenting. And a lot of us had a blackjack background. But we got friends and family to help us that didn't have the blackjack background. And we kind of assumed, oh, this is pretty easy. You know, you don't need a lot of skill to do this. But we kind of learned that you do need skill. And these other players that we had were probably missing hands. And after doing this for about a month, we had broken even or maybe lost a little bit of money. So we actually got out of the business for a few years. I personally kind of stayed in it. I lived very close to an Indian casino that 2 days a week paid 2-1 on blackjacks. And then there was another Indian casino a little further away where it cost $2 a shoe to bank blackjack. So Friday and Saturday, I would bank the bank blackjack, and on Tuesday and Wednesday, I would play the 2-1 blackjack. And then a few years later, started getting barred from playing blackjack, and it just, you know, the card rooms had picked up banking at that point, and that's when we kind of saw that there was a good opportunity there. Well, I have to say, my partner, Frank Schipani, a.k.a. Al Francesco, is the guy who really saw all this, and I have to say this is a man who has a lot of vision, and I am very thankful that he kind of coaxed us and sort of pushed the rest of us into doing this.
Yeah, for our listeners who don't know, this Al Francesco is the same guy who invented the big player concept. He hired Ken Houston and sort of pioneered Team Blackjack. And actually the way we met was in the mid-90s, he came out of retirement and put together an ace sequencing team. Right. And that's how we first met. So we were starting to get barred around 97 or something, and that's when you guys moved over into the banking?
Yep. And as chance would have it, we started in a small card room. There was another group in there who was doing the big blackjack game. We kind of got the game that they didn't want. And in retrospect, we probably shouldn't have made any money on the game because the action was pretty low. But we got lucky and made a little bit of money there, which piqued our interest. And from there, it just started to snowball. And I think by 1999, we were in 6 casinos. And by the year 2001, we were in 14 casinos. And one thing I should mention is in those early days, we called it banking. And now the official term is funded prop play. Funded proposition player. Yeah. Group or whatever.
So do the banks touch the cards? Are they just looking or what are they doing?
If you are in a casino acting as a funded prop player or you're in there individually as a banker, you never touch the cards. You have very little power. What an employee would do is basically watch the game and make sure that procedures are followed.
Well, and they sit on every table with racks of chips so that if the banking hand loses, they get paid not from the dealer out of the rack, but out of those racks of chips that are sitting there in front of the banker. And the winning bets get paid to that banker.
Okay.
So the house provides a dealer. The house is not participating in the action of the game. The house charges a collection, but the dealer handles all the cards and all the money. So the players never really, you know, obviously the player is going to put their own bet out and pick it back up if they win. But other than that...
Well, but there are some games where the players handle the cards, like three-card poker
sure.
is one, or pie-gow poker.
Yes.
They have to pick up the cards. Now, which leads to its own set of problems, because the card rooms in California are like the wild, wild west. I mean, cheating, at least back then, was rampant. I mean, and probably still today. How did you deal with that?
Well, we had quite a learning curve.
Expensive curve?
Expensive, no doubt about it. But somehow we survived. I would say that probably 90% of all funded prop player groups that have been in existence have gone bankrupt. It's a pretty tough business. When we first were involved in the business, I think what saved us was the card rooms saw their profits skyrocket when we put players on the tables, because now other players knew their action would be covered and they felt like they wanted to play there. Before that, you know, if you put out a $2,000 bet and there's only $200 in the bank and you get paid $200 for your win and you didn't get paid the $1,800 that you thought you should have won, you're going to be pretty upset about that. So people would just leave. So once we started putting players on the table, those players stayed. All kinds of cheating schemes have gone on in California. I think it's really been cleaned up as time has gone on, and with more and more regulations. In those early days, when we got involved, the state position was, is this legal or not? You know, we always felt that it was legal. And
you mean the whole banking thing?
Yes.
Is banking legal?
Yes. And after a few years, the state did come out and say, yes, it's legal, and we are going to regulate this industry. So
so can you tell us about some of the crazier cheating things that happen?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many stories. I think the first one I would mention is there was a small card room, only two tables, a blackjack table and a pie-gow poker table. We had a lot of accounts. I hadn't been into that club for a couple days. And when I got there, one of the employees told me, you know, there's something going on here. I'm not sure what it is, but I feel funny. So I said, well, why don't you take a break and let me sit on the game for a few minutes? And it was pie-gow poker. And there had been two new dealers hired that was a husband and wife. And when I first sat down on the table, the dealer was a guy I knew who had been there for at least a year. And there was a player who was betting about $40 per hand. The dealer got pushed. New dealer came in, and it happened to be the husband. And maybe the second or third hand that he dealt, the player who had been betting $40 bet $1,600. And just when the cards, or after the dice cup had been shook, I'm not sure, his wife came up next to me and tapped me on the leg and asked me a question. So I turned my head just for an instant.
The turn.
The distraction. And I thought I saw something moving out of the corner of my eye, but I wasn't sure. And the player who had bet $16 turns his hand over, and he's got two aces and a joker. And at that point,
I knew. That's a good start.
Yeah, I knew something was up. So eventually, after trying to watch the game and see what was going on, I couldn't really see anything. If I went outside and made a phone call or something like that, I'd come back in, and our banker had lost more money. So finally, I asked the pit boss. I pulled her aside and I said, I think something funny is going on here. And she said, so do I. And we went into the back room and looked at the tape. And sure enough, he was peeking at the dice cup. And we saw that the way he picked up the cards, he stacked the deck where he could get two aces together and a joker. And then he did a false shuffle where he only shuffled the top portion of the deck. He was pretty good. Very, very smooth. And this way, by controlling the dice cup and having one hand with you know, such a powerful two aces and a joker is very powerful. Pretty good chance you're going to win anytime you get that hand.
Sure. Yeah.
So and the funny part about it was, once we figured out what was going on, I called the owner of the casino, It was about 2 in the morning. He came in, you know, his hair was sticking up. He'd been sleeping, and I kind of aggressively grabbed the husband off of a hold'em game.
The dealer.
And told him to come with me, and I was probably out of line here a little bit. I actually grabbed him and threw him up against the wall and told him I should probably punch him. I had a bit of a temper. And then the owner and I left him under the custody of two security guards, and we went into the back room again, and I looked at him. I said, "So what do we do now?" And he said, "I don't know. Don't you know what to do?" And, you know, we had never come across this situation before, so we ended up calling the police. The police came. They didn't get what we were trying to tell them. They told us, "Look, we can trespass these guys, and if they ever come back, we'll arrest them for trespassing." So they got away with the money.
Did the dealer get fired?
They both got fired. Yeah. Yeah, they did.
Just seems like nobody ever gets prosecuted for this stuff in these rooms.
Especially back in those old days. I think the laws changed. I know in California now, if you use a device, you could definitely get prosecuted for that. But I'm not really aware of anybody that's gone to jail or prison for cheating in California. But it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case now. I think the laws have tightened up.
Now, as the banker, let's say you recognize Richard as a good blackjack player and somebody you really didn't want playing against you because you figured he wasn't there to lose. Did you have the power to request that he be removed, or did you have to take all comers no matter how good they were? How did that work?
Yeah, we would have to take all comers. But you know what? Richard wouldn't play. By definition, if you're an advantage player, you wouldn't come in to just bet blackjack.
Well, I mean, you're saying that you would take all comers, but you're an exception because I certainly was barred from play by other banking groups.
Well, you were in there banking probably.
No, I went in, you know, we were on an A-sequencing team together, okay. And I went in to play some of the shuffles. And actually, I went in with you one time at the Hustler. We went in, and Jimmy and... they just refused to deal to me. And yeah. I said to the pit boss, I'm like, are you a casino or not? How can you tell me? How can you say? He's like, well, it's their money. If they don't want to deal to you, they don't have to.
and it certainly varies from casino to casino. Some casinos protect the banking groups a lot more than others. Most casinos, or should I say card rooms, you know, if the banker's losing, obviously they don't want to lose their banker. They want to keep their prop group there. But on the other hand, in the short term, if the banking group is losing, that means that the players have more money, they're going to bet more, and therefore the house will make more collection.
Sure, it's better for the casino.
Sure, yeah, sure.
But it sounds to me like the rooms in Southern California are much more friendly to the bankers, and in Northern California, it seems like the players have more rights.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate assessment. Yes.
I know many people barred at Commerce, Bicycle,
those are
Hustler.
In Los Angeles County.
Yeah.
Back in those early days, there was a lot of competition. You know, other groups copied us. Come in and try to make a deal with the casino, that they'd see that we were making money. Sometimes we made a handshake deal with some of these groups. I remember a deal I made with one of the owners of a pretty successful group, not to go after each other's tables, and he reneged on that deal within a couple days. I found out, so we decided to sort of teach him a lesson. Then we went in and played blackjack against him, and in California in those days, the deck was riffled one time. So if you had a sequential tracking ability, this was like taking candy from a baby. And
because they had a game that was called like California 22 that had a joker in it.
That's right.
If you sequence a joker, it was like over a 90% edge. So
you could, if you had a joker, you could push, but you couldn't lose. So it was pretty strong. And you could vary your bet from $100 to $6,000. So we made a lot of money doing that. Kind of fun, I have to say.
Yeah.
Beat the competition a little bit. And we probably did that in a few card rooms. Didn't seem to slow them down, though.
Those banking operations make so much money, yeah. It's hard to put a dent in them.
Well, you have to hire a lot of people to be your employees. And if you said you had 14 casinos you were working at your heyday, and if you're banking all games, that's hundreds of employees, I would think.
Yes.
How do you train them? How do you make sure they're not stealing from
you?
Where
do you find them?
Well, originally when we first started, it was close friends and family that we hired. And we, sat around the kitchen table and gave them some pointers and sent them out there. A lot of people might have gotten 2 hours of training if they were lucky. And it was because we were, getting new accounts so fast that, we didn't have time to train them. My understanding is I'm out of the business now, and I've been out of it for several years, actually. But the group that I started, which is still in business, my understanding is now training takes about a month. So, and it could take longer.
Did you just go to a temp agency, or, where did you get them?
Pretty much once we hired somebody, they would have a friend that they recommended, or an uncle or a sister. We ended up having sometimes five or six people in the same family working for us. People wanted these jobs. We paid pretty well. We did give medical insurance. We allowed our players to invest so that they could get a return on their investment, which was pretty lucrative, especially in those early days. And we actually set it up where if you were an employee, you could win, but you couldn't lose. So their money, and it was just a way to get them more involved and feel like they were part of the whole show, so to speak.
But now they're still sitting on a table with racks full of chips. What percentage of them were stealing? And
I gotta believe a high percentage were stealing, and it could have been anywhere from maybe $100 chip here or there to several thousand. Eventually, we started losing a lot of our accounts. Competition came in. People offered the casino a much better deal than what we were offering them. And as we started losing accounts, we actually started making more money because we could focus. We weren't running around from casino to casino trying to plug holes and figure out who was doing what. As we lost accounts, we had much more control, and our profits actually went up.
Huh.
So no doubt about it, there was a lot of leaks in those early days.
So for players who want to go in and bank, they have the problem of the dealers cheating them, right?
Yes.
Like in Pai, this is something I remember from Pai Gow Poker. Explain how that would work.
Okay, well, first thing I want to say is most dealers are very professional and they do a great job.
Yeah. That's the politically correct thing to say.
But this is true. This is true. Most of them are just good people. But you have those dealers that are probably compulsive gamblers. They've borrowed money from the juice man or, gone to the pawn shop, and they're desperate for money. So they'll do whatever they can to make a buck. And really the big target in the card rooms is the funded prop player group. That's who they really go after. And the prop player groups make deals with the casino, and they agree upon a tipping structure. So the dealers know they're going to get tipped. But on the other hand, if they can cheat against the prop player group, they can get a tip from a player as well. Or maybe the player, if it's a couple thousand bucks, maybe they'll get a couple hundred bucks out in the parking lot. A lot of incentive to cheat. And the way they would do it is, I should probably explain what a buy bet is first, because
sure.
That's so in California, the bank has always rotated. Everybody has a chance to be the banker, and this is a big attraction. And when you're the bank, you have an advantage, and all the players know that. So Pigou Poker was probably the biggest game in California. It's probably been replaced by Baccarat now as the biggest game. But traditionally, it was always Pigou Poker. And in Pigou Poker, a player might come in, give some action to, maybe $1,000 on a couple hands to another banker. Then the next guy gets to bank, and then the next guy, and finally this new player who just sat down and might have, $10,000 or $15,000, wants to make some money as a banker. It's his or her turn to bank. Well, people are very superstitious, so if the previous two or three hands the bank had won, the players will say, oh, the bank's hot, and nobody bets. So this guy just came in, he's got $10,000 in front of him, and there's only $300 in action. So what we figured out way back in 1999 was, why don't we offer what we call a buy bet? And what this entails is that the player would ask us to bet against them. Now, why would we do that? Well, we would charge 4% of whatever the wager was.
And what's your negative expectation on the bet?
1.25%.
Great. So you're losing 1.25% and he's paying you 4%.
That's right.
That sounds like good business.
Yeah. And we had to pay collection out of that, and if we won, we would tip. But it was pretty lucrative. So what some games would just be nothing but buy bets. There could be $10,000 or $15,000 of action out there for hours, and it's just buy bets the whole time. And basically what they would do for each player, they would have little buttons that were colored, and they would put a different color button on each wager and the money that's in the bank, so you could see the correlation between player and funded prop group. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But anyways, the buy bets are all set houseway, which means that nobody looks at the hand. The dealer turns the hand over, each hand over one by one, sets it, and either calls it a winner or a loser, and then goes on to the next hand.
Or a push. Yeah.
Exactly. And in Pigou Poker, push is actually the most common hand. So thank you.
Yeah.
So what they would do is they would open the hand very quickly. And the example I'll give is a pretty simple one, but it could be anything. Supposing that the houseway hand is a king high straight in the five-card hand, and the two-card hand would be, say, a 6-3. Very, very likely this is a push. The 6-3 is going to almost always lose, and the straight is almost always going to win. So what the dealer would do, though, is they would say, king high, lose. They would open the hand very quickly, close it, call king high, lose. And then the banker would have to say, excuse me, I didn't really see that hand. Can you please show that to me again? And the dealer might glare at him and say, it's a king high. And the banker would say, well, I know, but it's my job. I have to see every hand. Please let me see it. And if it turns out that it was actually a straight and a push instead of a loss, the dealer would look at the banker and say, oh, I'm so sorry, my mistake. On the other hand, if it really was a king high, the dealer would then glare at the banker with one of those looks that if looks could kill, you'd be dead, intimidating the banker, and then next time, hopefully, the banker would not have enough backbone to ask again. And this is a game that these unscrupulous dealers will play over and over and over.
Yeah, I remember banking games where, somebody would ask two or three times, and they would just get a raft of flack from the dealer, because the dealer would call it right, but do it really fast. And, after three or four times of the dealer being right, suddenly they don't ask anymore, and then they just get raped.
That's right. So the prop players, this is part of the education process. And another thing that we would do is we would use spotters, secret shopper, basically, to go in and watch the banker and look for weaknesses like that. And if we noticed that a banker never, ever, ever called a hand back, we would actually tell him, even if you saw it perfectly, even if everything was by the book, we expect you to call at least one hand back per down per dealer, just so they would get in the habit of once in a while doing it, because you have to be assertive in this business. Mm. You really do.
Now, didn't you have some thing where some guy brought you to some hotel room to show you some Paigao?
So Paigao Tiles is probably the game that had the most elaborate cheating. We were aware of, people using sandpaper. I mean, before I get into that story, I can tell you one time we had a spotter sitting next to a player. He could see the sandpaper on the player's finger, which the player would use to mark the tiles. He gave, he gave my partner Jimmy a call. Jimmy called the Asian games director in that casino and said, listen, we know that this player is cheating and he's got sandpaper on our hand. On his hand, and the Asian games director said, no, he doesn't, and hung up the phone. So this is the type of thing we had to deal with in
this
business.
So he was in.
Yeah. So I found out about a guy that I'd met several times in the card room, very, very sharp guy. He had been an Asian games director in a few clubs, and he knew pretty much anything going on in the casino. And I approached him, and I said, listen, I'd like to learn a little bit more about what's going on in these tiles games. Is there anything you could show me? And he said, well, for $1,000, I can show you something. So he said, come to this little motel, little cheesy motel room that I went to. And he told me that a guy was going to be there. I'm not going to use his real name, but they called him I'll call him the Dragon Master, just to make the point. And as I was walking down the hallway, I saw a guy walking out towards the parking lot, and I said to myself, that must be the Dragon Master. I knocked on the door. The guy that I knew was there, and on the bed of this little motel room was a full set of tiles stacked up as a dealer would stack them up. And I looked at, he said, look at the tiles, see if you can find anything wrong with them. I looked, I inspected them very closely. Every tile looked 100% clean. In fact, they looked brand new. He had a cell phone laying on the bed, just sort of thrown on the bed. And over on the little desk, there was a monitor. And I looked at the monitor, and you could see all the tiles. So the cell phone had a camera in it. Then he switched. He hit a button on the cell phone. And the cell phone at that point, the camera on the cell phone, was filming in infrared. I looked at the monitor. It lit up like fireworks. Every single tile was marked, all four sides and the top. And if you were a player with a cell phone on the table and a little earpiece in your ear, you can imagine the damage done with a set of tiles like this. So we were pretty intrigued by this, and we were trying to think, how do we protect ourselves? So what we actually did is we asked if this guy, the Dragon Master, would come and have a seminar and teach our employees some of the cheating tricks that they use. And, we paid him a pretty good amount of money to do this, gave him a lot of respect. I'm sure what he actually showed our employees were tricks that they probably weren't using anymore, but it was still good to get the knowledge and to know that there are groups out there that do cheat. And by us doing this, we kind of built a little bit of a relationship with these guys. We even bought some equipment from them to educate ourselves. And when they wanted to do a cheating play, now we had a relationship with them, and instead of attacking us, they would go down to the next casino down the road. And I think that saved us a lot of money.
Sounds like it, yeah. Sounds like it.
We actually bought a dice cup from them that had a camera built into it. I mean, there was some very elaborate equipment that these cheaters would use. But again, the amount of money that you lose to these type of scams is probably a drop in the bucket compared to the daily grind of a dishonest dealer that is just trying to beat you.
And a dishonest employee.
Yes. If the employees are involved. A dealer and an employee working together are pretty powerful.
Yeah. What about the casinos themselves, the management trying to hire you to take you?
That could possibly happen in a small casino, and that probably wouldn't have been the management. It could be the Asian Games director. They had a lot of power. They might try to get a different banking group in there. There was a small casino that we went into one time to bank the tile table, and this was a tile table that had a shuffle machine built into it. And it shuffled the tiles very well. you know, there, no way to beat it if handled properly. But what we realized they were doing is they would, well, the way the shuffle machine worked was there was a little flap in the middle of the table. And when they wanted to shuffle, they would push a button and that flap would sort of fall down into the table. It would fold into the table. And then all the tiles were pushed into the table and they were automatically shuffled. And 30 seconds later, you'd have the tiles all stacked up neatly and ready to be dealt. The players would then cut the tiles. But the way they used this machine to their advantage is they would first push four tiles into the machine. And four tiles makes a hand. So the dealer might pick up some very, very strong tiles, push them in together, then make change, do some payouts, wait about 30 seconds, and then push all the other tiles into the machine. By doing that, it was known that those four tiles would wind up stacked on top of each other all the way to the right. And in this casino, after we took a pretty good loss, we went in the next day and we looked, inspected the table, and underneath the table we found tape. And we surmised that a magnet had been used, taped to the bottom of the table, and they had loaded dice in the dice cup. Now, I didn't really mention the dice cups. You know, this is it's a pretty good procedure. And, you know, the cards are shuffled, whether it's tiles or pie guy poker or blackjack. But what the dice cup does is it determines where the action starts. And if you don't know where the action starts, or in pie guy poker, it determines how the cards are going to be given out to the players. So there's seven piles of cards. You never know what pile you're going to get. So this is a good way to stop cheating. But, you know, if there's a camera in the dice cup, or if there's loaded dice, or if you're peeking at the dice cup, you know, these are all ways to get around it.
I've heard, too, they used there was like a radioactive dye on the dice, and they had a way of reading right through the metal of the cup.
Wow, I hadn't heard that one, but it wouldn't surprise me.
yeah.
So lots of scams. I mean, I can tell you most of them are tiles.
You had a guy with a device one time.
Right? That was in a game that's not very popular anymore called Pan 9, which was sort of a spin-off of Baccarat. Baccarat was not legal in California at that time, so people played Pan 9. And we were in a casino where the rule was you had to sit on a regular chair to play Pan 9. And actually, it was a game called Fast 9 that we actually invented. I'm digressing here a little bit, but the casino management approached us. We were only doing a blackjack game in this casino, and they approached us and said, look, we have this Pan 9 game here. There's no edge in the game. Nobody ever wants to bank the game. Our game goes about 4 hours a day. Can you figure out a way to give yourself a slight edge where you would want to bank this game? And, you know, really help us and hopefully help yourselves. And we came up with a game called Fast 9, which had an edge in it. And we made millions of dollars on that game. So it was pretty good. But so that was the game we were banking. It was called Fast 9. You had to sit on a low chair. The pit boss came over, a guy named Bernard. And I'll say why I'm mentioning his name. And he said, hey, this guy right here has got a bad bank back. We're going to let him sit on a stool. And the guy just kept beating us. And we'd watch him and watch him and watch him. We couldn't figure out what the heck he was doing. And one day, there was a blue deck, blue shoe being played. And all of a sudden, the cards were turned over, and there was a red card in there. Everybody started talking and saying, what the hell's going on here? And people got up off the table, and that player got up, went over to the cage, cashed out his chips, and we didn't see him for about 2 years.
Boy, that's balls that he had the nerve to go to the cage.
he got his money. And a couple years later, he was playing in another casino that we were banking, same game. And it might have only been a year later. I'm, you know, gets fuzzy here in the past. Anyways, our employee, a young woman that had worked for the police department, she had been a cop before, noticed that his arm was moving in a strange way. And she contacted security on her break, and they watched the guy on the camera, and they determined that he was cheating, and he did have a device in his arm, which would hold out cards. He could switch cards. He was very, very adept at doing this. And but they caught him. And as they led him to a back room, one of the security guards later told me that he noticed that the guy was chewing on something. And he grabbed the guy by the throat, which caused him to open his mouth, and the four of hearts came out of his mouth. It's a plastic card, pretty tough to swallow.
But again, he didn't go to jail, right?
I'm not sure what happened to him. Yeah.
And you didn't get your money back.
Didn't get our money back. So, and the reason I brought up the guy's name, Bernard, a couple years later, he approached us and said, listen, I got some great ideas. And I said, why would I talk to you? You helped this guy cheat. He said, no, I didn't. So, you know, who knows? But it turns out Bernard was a brilliant guy. He had some great ideas. We've worked on him with patents. And, you know, whatever happened there, that's ancient history. It's just funny how you meet people in this business. You know, you think somebody you can't trust at all, and wow, they come up with some incredible ideas. It just pays not to ever burn a bridge.
I have an old friend that I worked with for many, many years who used to say, the worst thing about this business is the people you have to work with, and the best thing about this business is the people you get to work with.
It's true. So. It's true. Yeah, all kinds of interesting people, all kinds of characters.
Tom Ardle, this was very interesting. We're going to have to do some commercials. And we have some more questions for you, and depending on how fast the commercials go. So please don't go away. Before we get to the commercials, I would like to give a heads up that you'll thank me for. There's a free university online. It's called Coursera. It's spelled Charlie, Oscar, Uniform, Radio, Samuel, Echo, Radio, Apple. So Coursera.org. It's free courses. Starting next week, Tuesday, is a course by Dan Ariely, Ariely. He's published books called Predictably Irrational. He's published books on The Optimal Way to Cheat. It's not gambling per se, but for people curious about life, take the course. The course is free. I got the bundle of books on Kindle through Amazon. It was $19.95 or something like that. So that's the only expense. It's a college course. He's taught through Duke University. You will be happy you did that. All right. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. They have progressive bonuses in March, each starting at $10,000 and guaranteed to be hit by $25,000. These awards are given to slot and video poker players. Should you be playing while someone else wins the award, you receive $20 in free play. Once a bonus jackpot hits, another one begins immediately at $10,000. This will go on throughout the month, 24 hours a day. They have a smaller daytime progressive starting each day at 11 a.m. It starts at $1,000, guaranteed to be hit by $2,500. When it hits, it doesn't start over again until 11 o'clock tomorrow. If you play during the day, likely both progressives are going and you have a shot at both of them. For 4 days, starting tonight through Sunday, they will have hourly virtual racing events, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, and 9:30. If you're listening live, you've already missed the first two. You must have played 100 points in the hour prior to the drawings to be eligible. At the appointed time on the iView screen on your machine, you'll be able to pick one of 8 NASCAR drivers who will then compete in a pre-recorded race. Everyone has chosen the correct driver, shares in the $5,000 total prize. In previous contests, the prizes averaged about $50, and you had a 1-in-8 chance to win, which gave you an EV of $6 an hour. It's a low roller play, but there is an advantage there. Playing NSU, it's an even game going in. The free video poker class at the South Point next Wednesday at noon will be triple double bonus. This is a fun game with a very high variance. That means you either win a lot or lose a lot. You have to have a certain personality in order to put up with the swings, but it does have a decent return. At the Palms, the March drawings have a different format than the February drawings. The drawings remain Friday evening at 7. You do not need to be present to win, but you must claim before midnight. You do need to swipe your card earlier in the day to activate your entries. In March, the Lucky Leprechaun drawings award $7,500 each Friday, and the winners return on Friday, March 28th, for another $10,000 in prizes. You earn 5 times tickets, Friday and Saturday evenings, 8 to midnight. The Play, Earn, and Win awards at the Palms for the first half of the month are daily events, Monday through Friday, rather than the more typical Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Until March 14th, the major gifts are gift cards usable at TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and Home Goods. So from March 17th to 28th, the prizes are from Tiffany Jewelers. And it appears this prize, you can earn points towards the gifts on all 7 days of the week. So 12 days in a row, you can earn points and then redeem them at the end should you wish. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy, Hyper Bonus, and many others. Often these games are the best returning games in a casino, and you need practice to make sure you know how to play. For their daily contest this week, they have 100 Play Draw Poker, Double Super Times Pay, and Caveman Keno. I have no advice on Caveman Keno. But regular Super Times Pay is a 6-coin per line game where approximately once every 15 hands you get a random multiplier ranging from 2x to 10x. The strategy stays the same as regular video poker and the game returns about 0.25% more than the base game. In Double Super Times Pay, you bet 7 coins per line and you get 2 separate chances for the multiplier, both on the deal and on the draw. Now the multiplier can add up to 20. Again, it requires no strategic changes, and the game returns about 0.5% more than the base game. Richard, why don't you tell us who's going to be on next week?
Next week we have Blair Rodman, who wrote the book Kill Phil, but we will be talking about his exploits at blackjack, poker, golf, sports betting. He's a Renaissance man, so.
All right. That should be fun. Tom Ardle, you mentioned Frank and Jimmy. Are there any other projects you were in with him that were really, I've heard you guys did really great stuff, and you got about 1 minute to tell us.
All right. Well, Frank and I did play a lot of blackjack together in the 90s. We started off shuffle tracking. And right when I got good at it, he said, let's switch to ace sequencing, but first we have to figure out how to do it. So we spent about 7 months together really working, analyzing shuffles, figuring out how to memorize cards, and we figured out how to do it and put a team together, made a lot of money at it. So, and that's when we started getting barred, pretty much at the same time that this opportunity opened up in the banking business. And yeah, Frank's a guy that if he has an idea and suggests we should do it, I definitely agree with him.
Yeah, he's a very creative, yes, creative guy.
Yeah.
So
that was interesting. Now he did the big player. So thank you, Tom Ardle. Thank you, Richard Munchkin. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.